You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Wednesday, 1 July. We've got NAMSA new vehicle sales due later this afternoon. I'm Simon Brown coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Zimile Mbandre. He is from FNB Wealth and Investments. The Absa trading update. So we've seen Standard Bank, Market loved it. Nedbank, yeah, Absa, yo, they did not like on this update. And I got to say, the stock is cheap, but we'll get Zimile's view on that. Ruan Naidu from 91. The new Fed chair, hawkish posture paired with her structural reform agenda. What are the thoughts after his first FOMC? And then we're going to chat with Morningstar investment success, less about accurate forecasts, more about being prepared for a range of potential outcomes. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb, Stellantis to decide on multi-billion rand SA plant within months. The facility will now produce a pickup plus at least one additional model. Business Day, Standard Bank, First Rand and Nedbank fume as torturous rand rigging case ends. Apex Court did not overturn the appeal court's insufficient evidence of collusion finding, easing a decade of reputational strain. Morning markets, US was green, S&P up 0.8%, NASDAQ up 1.7%. The East is mixed. We've got Sydney down 0.2%. We've got Tokyo up 0.2%. And then Hong Kong is closed for Special Administrative Region Establishment Day. No, I don't know what that means either, but it also means no numbers from Tencent. Commodities mixed. Gold futures, $3,990. Brent, $73.28. And on the red side, platinum, $1,549. Palladium, $1,204. The rand is 16.42. Bitcoin, $58,900. And top 40 opening call, a red open, but 4 points, technically flat.
MoneyWeb Now. On the Money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Zimile Mbandre, FNB Wealth and Investments. Zimile, appreciate the early morning time. The ABSA update. When I saw it come through and I read it ahead of market opening, and I thought to myself, it's not the most thrilling update I've seen, but yeah, it wasn't too bad. The stock certainly is cheap relative to perhaps the First Rands and Standard Banks of the world. But the market did not like, down almost 7%. What do you think they were looking at and so very disappointed about?
Morning, Simon. Thank you for having me. I think you touched on it at the beginning there. I mean, I think the markets, obviously, they will compare two peers and, you know, what we've seen so far during this reporting period. And obviously, I think the high-level metrics that we saw, or the key metrics that we saw, don't really compare that favorably relative to peers. I think another thing that took the market aback a bit was the Africa region, you know, performance. If you remember last previous financial year, Africa region RPB, retail business and business banking earnings grew around 51%. Now, you know, 6 months later, the management is guiding for the Africa business to see earnings decline, you know, impacted by lower interest income because of the rate cutting cycles there and higher credit impairments. So just that sharp reversal in such a short period of time, I think that took the market aback a bit. But we also, you know, as I said, they spoke about, you know, the rand strength, obviously that affecting the translation from the Africa revenue. And also ROE guidance was flat. Initially, last year, management had guided for ROE this year to be around 16%. Now they're expecting it to be around 15%, slightly higher than what it is right now. That also, I think, was very disappointing to the market. Again, you know, it does not necessarily compare that favorably to peers. And also just Jaws, the Jaws ratio also is expected to be negative with costs rising a bit faster than revenue there. So, a lot of these small, well, not necessarily small, but a couple of points where I think the market market was taken aback a little bit. As I said, it does not necessarily compare favorably against peers.
I get your point. And we are, I mean, is it fair to say we're starting to get almost a two-tier, although maybe let's park Capitec aside. But on the one end, we've got sort of F&B and First Rand and Standard Bank at around 2x price to book. There, the market is saying the quality. And then the Nedbanks at the Absa's at around 1.1x to book. And they're saying, must try harder. Is that kind of fair in what you see across our banking landscape?
Yeah, that's what it looks like it's shaping up to be. There's I suppose tale of two cities, but I think there's, I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, Absa is relatively cheaper, your Nedbanks as well. So I think definitely there is value if they get the things right. And I think for the most part, I mean, if you look at the other metrics, you know, from Absa, mostly positive. I mean, from a guidance perspective, they maintained everything other than ROE. You know, the South Africa business performed really well. So, you know, I mean, if they can get it right, and they expect the businesses in Africa, they expect, you know, NII to normalize in the next second half. And going forward, I mean, they maintain their long-term guidance for ROE to be around 16% to 19% between 2027 and 2030. Mm-hmm. And cost to income to lower and improve toward that 50% mark, which is comparable to the rest of the market very favorably. So I think there is value there in the longer term, but I think the short-term noise, that's what obviously the market will react to. And right now, there is that sort of separation between those banks, your First Rands and your Standard Banks of this world, compared to the Nedbanks and your Absas.
And I like your point. I mean, this perhaps is more short term. I mean, and these play out over time, but we'll see how that goes. But we'll leave it there for now. Appreciate the early morning time. It's Emmanuel Bantra, F&B Wealth and Investments. Appreciate the time. Give your money the return at once without taking a flight with the StanLib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting with Rowan Naidu, he's portfolio manager at 91. Rowan, appreciate the time today. We had our new Fed chair in his first FOMC a couple of weeks ago, the resulting press conference. I got to say, I thought he wasn't going to take questions at the press conference, but in the end, he did. You and your colleagues have written an article on it, and I think the key takeaway, perhaps, hawkish posture paired with structural reform agenda does seem to be very much the headline takeaway from the new chair.
Yes, certainly. That question about whether he was going to answer questions at the press conference is definitely a question I had in my mind as well. But big institutional overhaul coming through and a bit of a hawkish shift. I mean, the first sign of it was in the statement. So the Fed releases a statement with its FOMC meeting, and that statement was drastically shortened.
Yeah.
And it had a very important signal towards the end, where it had this very, very pointed statement that the committee will deliver price stability.
And to be clear, they've got two mandates. One of them is price stability, but the new chair, Wash, is very much pegging his on this is his North Star. And it's 2%. There's no talk of changing that either.
So interestingly, there's an inflation framework task group that he has set up. So this will now re-examine what are the drivers of inflation, potentially what is the right level of inflation for the economy at any given point in time. But in the press conference, he stated quite clearly that while they are currently above that 2% target, it would be suboptimal to start making changes to the goalpost at this point. So for now, 2% is the target.
And a fair bit of structural reforms. I mean, you know, to the point, I mean, he set up five different sort of, you know, task committees and the like. And I mean, nothing wrong with, I suppose, reviewing something, notwithstanding it's worked over a number of crises. Fair shot to have a fresh look.
Yes, I think Kevin Warsh, prior to coming into the Fed, was very critical of the Fed.
Yeah.
He was a governor from 2006 to 2011, and then he left in 2011 because he was quite dismayed by the use of balance sheet, so-called quantitative easing. So he's very much against that. He believes it, you know, the very active Fed dampens market signals, and then markets effectively just pricing what the Fed is going to do, which removes an important signal. So he'd like to see markets price what the Fed should be doing. So he's introduced these five internal task forces, and one of them is around communications. So we've got that short statement. We had the dot plot. In future, we might not get a dot plot. We might not get forward guidance. So that's about letting the market be on its own. There's a task force on the balance sheet. We know he's against the balance sheet, so he wants to restrict the size of that. He's looking at data sources as well. So there's a task team for that because, you know, survey responses have been very low recently and the quality of data has been poor. So he wants to look at that in the new world. And then prior to coming in, he spoke a lot about how interest rates could be lowered because of productivity around AI. So there's a task group set up to look at that as well.
Gotcha. And he did. I want to go to that dot plot because he did not do a dot plot. Other members did. He patently didn't. And that kind of ties in with what the Fed should be doing. In other words, you can see the same data the Fed is seeing. There's a, you know, a CPI print, a core print, whatever it might be that you're looking at. You almost don't need dot plots because the market can see what the Fed can see.
Yeah, fair enough. The dot plot was a relatively new innovation for the Fed, and it was there specifically for the low interest rate environment. So when interest rates got down to zero post the GFC, nobody believed that they would stay there for a long time. So you'd see yield curves pricing a potential increase in the Fed funds rate over the next year. So the Fed wanted to push back against that. So what they did was they introduced this dot plot that shows that interest rates are going to remain at zero for this year, next year, and the year after, sort of the forward guidance. So in a world where we are no longer at zero interest rates, you could argue that there isn't a need for a dot plot anymore. And yes, Kevin Warsh did not submit a dot plot estimate for where he thinks policy rate should be. But I'd push back a little bit and say that what we do need is we do need to understand the Fed's reaction function. As you said, they mandated to have two potential goals, the goal on unemployment rate and a goal on inflation. And these two work against each other from time to time in terms of what your policy tool needs to do. So we, that's what's missing here, is we have no clear understanding of what the Fed, or particularly Kevin Warsh's reaction function, is going to be.
I get your point. And I mean, it was almost in a sense, like what you're saying, it was insight into that thinking, perhaps, that we got that was so important. And what it, and some of that insight was that nine of the members all plotted their dot plot to tighter policy, which is probably not what the new chair wants.
Potentially not. And it was a surprise to ourselves included. I mean, we're Fed watchers, so we look at every line in every speech of every Fed speaker. And, you know, I expected maybe three or four of them to come out with the potential hikes, but to see nine of them was quite a big surprise. And I think it gives you a message that they are very uncomfortable with the level of inflation and how long it has been above the target.
Yeah, as a Fed watcher then, and I appreciate the self-appointed title, does the midterms matter? I mean, November, do they want to be, if they're raising, done before? I mean, is it on the Fed's mind as we see? Because, I mean, in America, this is a two-yearly cycle, either it's presidential or midterm.
Yeah, correct. You know, 2026 midterm elections coming up in November. Let's look back 4 years ago, 2022, as we were going into the midterms. What were they doing? They were hiking interest rates. In 2018, when Powell was there, going into the midterms, they were hiking interest rates. So you could look at this historically and say, you know, there's no empirical proof that the Fed is shy about hiking interest rates into the midterms. So I don't think it would be a driving factor for the timing of any changes.
Like that. Shouldn't be shy. Absolutely. We'd leave it there. Troy Naidu, Portfolio Manager at 91. Appreciate the time.
And that's our poll today on LinkedIn. I mean, it's still early days. It's only one FOMC down so far. There are going to be many, many more over Warsh's term. But your thoughts so far. Have your vote. Have your say. LinkedIn. The Standard Flexible Income Fund delivers capital preservation and consistent top quartile inflation beating returns. Let your money keep working with Stanlib Asset Management even after you retire.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Sean Nithling, he's head of investments at Morningstar. Sean, appreciate the time. A recent note out from yourself and your colleagues talking around investment success and talking particularly around how markets have perhaps become
structurally harder to predict. And this isn't just geopolitical. I'm thinking there's also technology. Things are changing at rates that just sort of unprecedented, even just, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 years ago.
Yes, Simon. So firstly, thanks for having me on your show. I think if you look at the world today, you know, the way we look at things at Morningstar, there are probably two main forces that are almost reshaping markets. The first is, let's call it geopolitics. Mm-hmm. And we're really moving from a rules-based, almost multilateral system to a more fragmented world where you're seeing the emergence and the influence of, you know, one or two key people in the political space. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a world where, you know, a number of decisions are being made by a small group of leaders, and these decisions can impact markets, whether it's equities, bonds, currency, or commodities, in a very pronounced way. So that's the, let's say, the first, I suppose, force that's mainly shifting and predominantly out of the US. And then I think if you look at a theme which has been in play for a fairly long time, but we're seeing it accelerating, is really technology and technological advancements. So this is really advances in machine learning and AI, and accelerating the pace of change across industries. So what you're seeing here is it's compressing timelines, it's creating a lot of uncertainty, and you're getting this really narrow grouping of winners and losers. So what we're seeing there is this pace of change, which is rapidly accelerating. And again, in an environment where, you know, it's not especially clear how these technologies will necessarily unlock value in businesses. So I think, you know, those dynamics introduce a lot of uncertainty, a lot of unpredictability that's difficult to model, especially using, I suppose, traditional frameworks. So I think the toolkit that investors need to rely on now needs to be a lot more deliberate, you know, instead of, you know, trying to be particularly right on something, I think it's more important to prepare for those different potential outcomes.
I like that. Sort of more about managing probabilities, perhaps, than anything else. And probabilities, because we're not sure what's going to play out, but you can sort of learn to adapt and respond.
Yeah, 100%. Look, I think the current environment is especially choppy. So trying to predict or speculate or forecast how things are likely to play out is not an especially useful way to spend time. So it sounds a bit cliche, but it's better to prepare than to predict. So I think instead of, you know, try to think about specific outcomes, look at the distribution of potential outcomes or probable outcomes. What do those payoff profiles look like in terms of being right or wrong? And then most importantly for investors, I think how to think about how portfolios behave under different scenarios. So the value of preparation in an environment like this, and in just being aware and thinking through those different probabilities, is massively important.
I get that. And I like that. It's how they respond. I imagine it's also perhaps sort of around breadth, widening the net across maybe asset classes, maybe geographies, particularly a lot of it, I suspect, well, some of it is certainly going to be looking for mispricing, and that's going to need a wider net.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, another cliche, but, you know, diversification is often cited as your only free lunch. I think in an environment like this, it's massively important to think about how you think about that diversification. So, you know, when you look at different regions around the world, and we've been in this environment where, you know, the US has outperformed for a particularly long period in time, despite being, you know, optically expensive. But, you know, if you choose to invest or underinvest or underweight positions in the US or not invest, that is a decision in and of itself. So I think what you find in an environment like this is there's parts of the world that are especially attractive in terms of being cheap, and there's parts of the world that are more expensive. But I think in this type of environment where you do have these uncertainties, it doesn't necessarily mean that you only buy cheap assets or you only avoid or underweight expensive assets. I think the way you put that puzzle together in a client portfolio is probably one of the more important decisions to make.
In other words, less around strong views and the theme that you've been saying, it's back to process.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, in an environment like this, it's important for investors to stick to their philosophy in terms of how they allocate capital and how they allocate money. So, you know, at Morningstar, we are fundamental long-term investors, and our framework is anchored on that. Our process is very much iterative. So, you know, we learn from things that have worked really well. And when things don't work out really as they should in line with expectations, it's important to pretty much revisit your assumptions and try to stress test why things haven't worked out as expected. So I think the investment process and being malleable about that while making sure that you build robust portfolios is something in an environment where there is a lot of unpredictability. And like I mentioned up front, you've got massive technological change. Again, plus, you know, one particularly influential figure in US President Donald Trump that can shift markets in a very pronounced way.
Yeah, and I hate the phrase that this time is different, but we really are in a different environment. As you said, I mean, one is the president of the US, the other is technology. This really is different times. I leave it there. Sean Nethling, head of investments, Morningstar. Always appreciate the time.
That's it for today. Yesterday, I was chatting with Jimmy Muyoha, talking around NASPAS and process results. It's still all about Tencent, but things are happening. Takealot made an adjusted EBITDA profit for the first time. We asked you if you tend to use Takealot over the local Amazon online store. Almost half said yes, Takealot rocks. A third said whichever is cheaper, fair shout. Rest was split between nope, you're liking Amazon, and neither, you prefer to go in store. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobokle, Nicole, Sabu, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow, the messy middle.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.